Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013, and you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This late-night edition of Carson's Corner on Sunday, 11 p.m. My name is Bob Carson, and it is July 20th, 2014. Pleased to be with you here this evening. If you want to give me a call, the phone number is 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. We also have the chat room open for you as well, so feel free to chime in in the chat room. And by the way, in case you didn't know, the opening song that we play here is Voice of the Voiceless by Rage Against the Machine. And, you know, I'm not kidding when I say that every time I listen to that song, I get so emotional. I believe the song is about Mumia Abu-Jamal, who many people feel is a political prisoner. And, you know, just the lyrics within that song, there's one, you know, Zachary De La Rocha and Rage Against the Machine, they write, you know, I mean, these guys have been writing lyrics and just poetry. It's just, it's brilliant, brilliant stuff. The music fits so well with the lyrics. Everything about these guys is just amazing. They're incredibly in tune to the issues. They're outside the box. And they're really revolutionary, and they're really an inspiration, because I always say, you know, when the material conditions of capitalism get you down, and believe me, we're all down, okay? You've got almost half of Americans are underwater. You've got a economic system which says that you're six times more likely to go into poverty than you are to become wealthy. We have no upwards mobility in this country. The new normal of capitalism extends to many fronts, and they all equal a certain amount of oppression, economic oppression, for all of us. But one of my ways to escape the conditions is to listen to Rage Against the Machine. And every time I listen to Rage Against the Machine, I get inspired. And in the music, in the song Voice of the Voiceless, there's one line that says, "Let there be no rich white life we're bound to respect." And I was actually, you know, thinking about getting a bumper sticker, but it'd be too long to put on the back of my car. But it's so prophetic. It really is so in depth, and it's true, because, you know, in the United States, we're bound to respect wealth. We're bound to respect the corporate state. We cannot talk about these things. We cannot, you know, because the airwaves, we understand, are not reserved for us. There's a filtering system that the corporate media uses to, you know, advance certain points of view, and those that are outside of that structure, those that question the economic system, those that question the balance of power in America are marginalized. I mean, this is nothing new here. This is, you know, there's really no question about that. And, you know, I was listening to, you heard at the top of the show, Andrew Craig, who's the executive director of the Justice Integrity Project. And he was on my show a little earlier this year, February, I believe, of this year, talking about his book, Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I re-listened to this interview the other day, and he tells a story about how he was with at some sort of dinner or some buffet or some sort of gathering, and Chris Matthews was there, the, you know, the MSNBC puppet that we see, the political guy, right, who just, you know, just loves politics. Everything's politics, politics. It's all valid. It all, you know, the two parties mean something. Elections mean something. And Andrew Craig, and this, you could listen to this, he said this in an interview. He said, "How come you never tell your audience who pays your guests?" And what he's talking about is these guys that work, you know, for various different industries. They're lobbyists, they work for this industry, they work for that industry, and they get presented to the American public as if they're some sort of an expert. And, of course, MSNBC, none of the cable news channels ever disclose this, because you know, it would corrupt, or it would make people wonder about the message that they're receiving. And this correlates to what Ralph Nader talks about in his book, which I broadcasted not last week, the week before. I read Ralph Nader's new book, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. It's called Unstoppable. And Ralph Nader makes a very, very good point. And, you know, he's one of the intellectual authorities, certainly in my life, and I'm sure in many of your lives. You know, if you're listening to this program right now, it's undoubtedly Ralph Nader that has inspired you to do so. Or if not, you've definitely heard of his work or been familiar with some of his campaign runs that he's had. And, you know, last week we had Christopher Allen Driscoll on the show, who was actually Ralph Nader's media director in 2008. And Christopher is brilliant. We want to have him on the show again. But Ralph Nader talks about, you know, the corporate state and how in the United States of America, when Walmart or when any other special interest, when any other section of the corporate state wants to kill a piece of legislation, when they want to influence the discussion, as these corporate interests do, they control the discussion. Corporations control the media. They're built to loot, as Chuck Collins says. And so what they do is they can't have a Bank of America. They can't have a Walmart radio host. You know, you can't have NASCAR patches on these right-wing corporate hosts that are believe in corporate statism, trying to uphold the corporate state. So what they'll do is they'll send their guys on. They'll send somebody from this institution, that institution, fill in the blank. And there is a vast amount, there's really an unlimited amount of resources going to reinforce and expand the corporate state. It's called right-wing talk radio. It's called the right-wing think tanks. It's political action committees. It's newspapers. There's just a huge, huge industry that is virtually limitless in terms of resources. And so that's how they get their opinion out there, and that's how they influence the debate. That's how they control debate. And if you look at these right-wing radio hosts, there's, you know, I always say right-wing talk radio is like the sky. No matter where you go, you can't escape it, right? I mean, you can't sit in your car and listen to AM or FM radio without a dose of what Lamar Waldron would call carefully crafted right-wing propaganda. And that's true. I mean, there is no alternative to other than that. There is no other side. There is no additional part of the discourse. It's all, you know, very, very libertarian, if not, you know, ultra-libertarian. So, you know, that's why you get all these labels that come out, the conservative, Reagan conservative, Thatcher conservative, blah, 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 conservative, blah, 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 conservative. I mean, there's hundreds of labels, you know, applied to conservatism. And as Ralph Nader talks about, the label conservative really is used by power brokers to provide semantic cover to big business and big government, okay, which are two of the same, because we know that corporations are the seekers. Corporations spend billions of dollars each year. Corporations write our legislation. They interpret our legislation. They make the campaign donations. They control the message. They lobby for subsidies. I mean, just, you know, you could just go on and on and on. And what you'll find is that their money, you know, is funding all of these hosts. So, you know, you've got these fascist demagogues, as Ralph Nader calls them, just trying to control the debate. And, of course, they're against the minimum wage, any type of minimum wage increase. Not that that necessarily would matter in a capitalist system, but, of course, they're against unionization. Of course, they're for the freedom and liberty. These words, these, you know, freedom and liberty, they're two of the most perverted words out there now, because they only extend to the billionaires. They only extend to the corporate state. That's what freedom and liberty means. Freedom for corporations or a billionaire not to pay taxes. You know, freedom for them to fire you and you not being able to eat and you dying as a result. You know, Milton Friedman, one of the most sociopathic men, in my opinion, just a guy that you see him, the hair on the back of your neck stands up, just what he stood for, and the you know, callousness of you know, his ideology and the work and you know, his comments and, you know, what he did in with the Chicago Boys and Chile and you know, just, you could just really look at really just a sick man. This guy, you know, made the argument that it's okay for a company to shut off someone's, you know, power if he didn't pay a bill, even though that person that resulted in that person's death. And this goes into the Zeitgeist work, how, you know, the basis of rationale with Milton Friedman and others, you know, other intellectual authorities on the libertarian side, never leaves the sequence of money. And that is where we're at in America. And that all ties in. I don't want to seem like I'm jumping all over the place, because I'm really not, in my opinion. I think this all ties in to what we're seeing right now. And it all ties into, you know, the corporate state right now. A good example of this, you know, in 2008 with the financial collapse, right, you would have thought that there would have been an alternative to the new normal of capitalism. And when I say the new normal of capitalism, I'm talking about the tax rate. I'm talking about taxes. We know that taxes in America are historically low right now. The wealthy have a myriad of tax loopholes, allowable deductions, tax advantages that are not accessible to you and I. We have a United States tax code that is swelled to over 70,000 pages. Now, these tax laws are being written, these tax loopholes are being written for and by corporations, groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the same groups that are, you know, funding these right-wing infrastructure groups like the Chamber of Commerce, who is a business partner of Fox News, Bain Capital, Walmart, all these different, you know, these corporations that control us and control the government, they have total rule over our tax code, right? We have the CEO pay. This is part of the new normal of capitalism, where we accept that it's okay for a CEO to make 500 times the lowest paid worker. It's okay that we pay a Wall Street hedge fund speculator hundreds of billions of dollars each year, and a scientist trying to cure a disease for the betterment of society is marginalized, is really demonized in our sick value system that we have in America right now. We have a new normal of capitalism when it comes to unionization. Well, it's illegal to unionize in America right now. Workers are treated as disposable. Human work is viewed as a commodity, nothing more. And the sequence of money, the mobility of capital, is more important than the mobility of labor. In fact, we don't have labor laws in America. We don't have a system of organized labor. We have a system of organized labor control. That's what we have here. Jobs and you know, the globalization of our economy, all of this is the new normal of capitalism, and this has made our lives, this has made our standard of living worse over the last 30-plus years, okay? And so you would have thought that there would have been a alternative. You would have thought that there would have been a change from the status quo after the conditions of capitalism became the, you know, volatile nature of the financial institutions became apparent in 2008. Well, what happened was, you know, President Obama came. He was, of course, a verbal agent of change. He had a very, very progressive-sounding campaign. And sure enough, Obama revealed himself to be a corporatist. Nothing, you know, a more effective evil, as Danny Haifung said on this program last week. Danny Haifung is an author or a writer for the Black Agenda Report. He's a recent college graduate, a young student, and very, very impressive. And so President Obama and Clinton, they have been the more effective evil, but nonetheless, they represent still the same corporate forces that exist. And so, you know, now we don't have an alternative. And a good way to look at this, and a good way to sort of relate what we're seeing right now to understand who has the power in our society? And this is mentioned, of course, in Ralph Nader's book. Now, Ralph Nader talks about what is your breaking point, right? At what point do you say, okay, you know what, this system is inherently flawed. Both political parties are serving the needs and interests of the business community. Okay, it doesn't matter. America is like a line. It's, you know, whoever's rich is first gets served. Whoever's, you know, has more money gets served first. I mean, you know, we have a corporate government. Corporations are the seekers. The functions of government have been taken over by corporations. The countervailing institutions have been just obliterated, right? Well, so what happens is the very individuals that ruined their economy, okay, you know, that was a breaking point for many people in 2008, the collapse of the economy. But for me, the breaking point was in 2010 when President Obama extended the Bush tax cuts, when President Obama froze the pay of federal workers. But that's beside the point. After the financial collapse in 2008, you would have thought that someone like Robert Rubin, okay, who was a Clinton guy, Robert Rubin is a man who is indifferent to human life, okay? He's no different than any of the people that I've criticized on the libertarian side. He's no different than Milton Friedman. He's no different than Mitt Romney. Okay, he's no different than Paul Singer, the most Wetico, egregious Wall Street hedge fund speculator, A-type personality, you know, just someone who you know, is swimming in money like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street, right? He was lobbied away from his regulatory post to deregulate the government. He helped, he had a major hand in collapsing the economy. We lost, according to, I believe it was Professor William Black, $21 trillion in production since 2008, okay? The human loss, the amount of human suffering is incalculable. We can't possibly calculate just how devastating the 2008 collapse was. And yet this guy has not lost any credibility. Robert Rubin is still as credible in the corporate media as anybody. He's as credible as Dick Cheney or any of the right-wing war hawks that are pushing for another war in Iraq. He's not discarded. He's not marginalized. Okay, he still has the power. He still has the credibility. And I'll tell you something. If Hillary Clinton runs, okay, if you know, the Lord or Master Clinton, if she runs, then don't be surprised if he gets his fingers in the till again. All right? So then the question becomes, you've got the 2008 collapse. You've got the new normal of capitalism, the new normals of capitalism, which I just mentioned. Right? You've got the material conditions of capitalism deteriorating. No alternative other than to move towards a complete corporate state. At what point do these people lose credibility? At what point do our institutions, you know, become invalid in the minds of the majority of Americans? You know, at what point do we say, okay, enough is enough. I'm tired of this. I'm not going to continue to vote. I'm not going to continue to legitimize the very interests that are, ruling my life and making America a horrendous place to live for most Americans. You know, I am no longer going to support the lords and masters. And, you know, Ralph Nader points out that in 2008, the lords and masters, they put their guys in charge. I mean, this is, you know, they circumvented the government, you know, because if you go back to 2008, it wasn't Obama on television for the most part. It was Hank Paulson. It was these bankers, Larry Summers, you know, Robert Rubin, the very individuals that orchestrated the collapse of 2008. Okay, these individuals were part of the quote cleanup. These were the individuals that are going to somehow fix the economy. If a police officer was going to catch a bank robber would expect him to work with the bank robber to solve the crime? No, the police officer would presumably put the bank robber in jail. But we have such a flawed system in America. We have such a distorted value system, maybe a value system disorder that Peter Joseph talks about, that these individuals not only do not lose credibility, these individuals are still part of the scene. These individuals are still part of the decision-making process in America, and it's really disgusting. And it really is. I mean, this is what we have right now in this country. And you know what's important too, as we study corporations, and this is a main theme of this program. Okay, this is what I really dedicated a lot of my study to, is fighting back against the corporate state, raising awareness about the flaws within capitalism, how the system is fundamentally geared towards the wealthy, raising awareness about why we have a lack of upwards mobility and why we have a tax system that is regressive for the vast majority of Americans who are wage earners and who make a salary, who get their taxes taken out before they receive their paycheck, unlike the businessman who has a variety of loopholes, unlike the corporations that have total control of the place. Dick Durbin, you know, said, was in 2009, 2010, about Wall Street, they own the place. Well, they do own the place. There's no question about it. What we have to understand is that this is beyond both political parties. This is not about Democrats, Republicans. Both parties are essentially two factions of the business party, in which you have the Republican Party, which is moving towards fascism, and you have the Democratic Party, which mirrors the Republican Party, perhaps of the 1950s or so. And these corporations, as Ralph Nader talks about, have their own ideological imperatives. This is very important because corporations are, not monolithic. Everybody that is part of corporate America, every person that's, part of the executive board or part of a shareholder in a corporation, they don't necessarily agree on every single issue. I mean, they're not. It's not like they're walking in lockstep. But on the core issues, and this is what unites both political parties, on the core issues of taxation, these corporations do not want to pay taxes. This is the new normal. It used to be years ago, with Ronald Reagan, corporations would pay, a much higher effective tax rate. Well, guess what? They're not paying taxes anymore. Okay, the average corporation pays 11% in taxes right now. And so what happens is that you and I have to fit the bill. They dodge the tax bill, and they pass it to you and I, right? This is the new normal of capitalism. Not paying taxes is part of the corporate strategy. The tax code is essentially part of their business model. And you and I, I view taxes as necessary to maintain and to sustain the socialist ideas that we love, the socialist programs, socialist-like programs that we take advantage of and we love. There are certain things that are good about our economy, are good about our country, none of which involve the profit motive, all right? And so, that's how I view taxes. But no, taxes have been used as a political football. And now both political parties, the Democrats, never hear them talking about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. So, this is part of the new normal now. They also have ideological imperatives when it comes to free trade. There's a reason that our free trade agreements are going through and are being negotiated in the dark, and this gives no power to any of us. The free trade agreements, and again, this is under a Democratic president. The two Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton, who signed NAFTA, right? The WTO and all these trade agreements that reduce our safety standards to the lowest common denominator. That was, you know, under Clinton, and Clinton, you know, was a more effective evil in that sense. Well, now you've got President Obama trying to do the same thing, and you could bet that, you know, the free trade agreement that he's trying to push for fast track is more aggressive, will be more detrimental to the American worker. Okay, well, this is something that corporate America supports by and large. Corporate America and their you know, legions of armies support and are trying to deliver to the American people and trying to inflict upon us. This is an ideological imperative. When it comes to, you know, the upholding of capitalism, you know, the structural adjustment of America, you know, David Harvey talks about how they run up the debt and you pay for it. That's absolutely true. The wealthy run up the debt in America. They have been for the last 30-plus years, okay, ever since Ronald Reagan came in, but, you know, this is not this didn't begin at, you know, during Ronald Reagan's presidency. Reagan kicked it into overdrive. The Reagan Revolution was a revolution in thought, just like the Thatcher. Thatcher set out to change the soul in 78, and Thatcher did that. And Thatcher, you know, now, as somebody pointed out, and David Harvey mentioned this at a speech he did a couple of years ago, it's easier to imagine the end of the world as it is an end to capitalism. And so, you know, Reagan built off of that. And so, you know, now we have these agreements, and we have the more effective evil presidents in President Obama and Bill Clinton, who are every bit as dedicated to advancing the corporate state while trying to sound a little bit more sympathetic to the average working man. Now, another thing Ralph Nader talks about, and this is very important too, because there are a lot of similarities between our economy in 1930 and 2008. If you look at the run-up to the financial collapse in 2008, okay, one key thing hits you when you look at the run-up to the Great Depression, the stock market collapse of 1929, okay? At that point, and this is, I believe, chronicled by Robert Reich, the top 1% of income earners in the lead-up to the Great Depression earned about 24-25% of the overall income, okay? They undoubtedly experienced all of the income growth. All of the wealth consolidation went to the top, okay? And so, you know, what happened is you had a massive amount of speculation, all right, deregulation. You had three Republican presidents in a row that, you know, essentially did what we did for 30-plus years, starting with Ronald Reagan, you know, cut taxes. You had, you know, the so-called Coolidge prosperity. You know, it's just the same thing, a massive amount of deregulation, a land boom in, you know, Florida, a hurricane that, you know. So you had this, and inevitably it collapsed in 2019. Well, the same thing started to happen under Ronald Reagan. When Reagan instituted his tax cut in 1981, I believe, at the behest of the Heritage Foundation. Remember, Reagan's tax plan was crafted by the Heritage Foundation, which is really a, you know, fascist institution, a very powerful institution dedicated to a corporate state. The top 1% of income earners began to earn more and more and more of the overall income, to the point where it peaked possibly. I haven't looked at the statistics in a few years, but it peaked right around the time of 2008, where you had 1% of income earners that were earning, you know, 24-25% of all of the income and all of the wealth. And this resulted in, or this, you know, contributed to a massive amount of speculation, which inevitably was due to bust. And this added to our deficit, added to our debt. They run up the debt. We spend trillions of dollars bailing out Wall Street. Okay, some estimates put it in the tens of trillions of dollars, bailing out banks, UBS, all the very banks that orchestrated our failure, our demise. Okay, and still we pay for it. We've been paying for it ever since 2008. President Obama has created the model for austerity. President Obama has showed the American people how we're going to cut. He's bought into the notion that somehow we have a spending problem, and as a result, we have to structurally adjust America. And that is at the behest of the elites. We always pay for it. We're under a class assault. Structural adjustment means a class assault, okay? This is happening to teachers. It's happening to workers. It's happening to immigrants, okay? It's happening all around us. And so what we have to do is we have to raise class awareness. We have to make sure that, we use our dissent wisely. And the best way that I could see it right now is not going with third parties. That's just, it's the system, as we know, is designed to, preserve the status quo. Politicians are elected to keep things the same. They're not elected to change things. The best way to do that, the best way is to raise class awareness, is to reject the current system completely and not vote at all. Why are we going to vote at all? Why would we, cast our ballot to one of two political parties that are both beholden to the business community, that on essential issues of deregulation, on essential issues of taxation, huge military budgets, free trade, they're the same. There is no difference because this is the ideological imperative of corporations. Again, corporations are not monoliths, but they have certain imperatives and they use the government to achieve the most feasible outcomes by controlling the government. And it's really, really sad. But another comparison of the 1930s, and I think this is very, very important, is that at least in the 1930s, you had alternatives to capitalism. You had alternatives to the current status quo. And Ralph Nader points out, too, that conservative writers in the 30s were much different than they are today. I mean, you did not have a defense of corporate personhood. You had conservative writers living near dirt poverty. They weren't wealthy. They weren't part of the right-wing media complex, which, pays people like Rush Limbaugh hundreds and Glenn Beck hundreds of millions of dollars. Same corporations that are structurally adjusting us, that are working overtime to reduce your pay, are sponsoring these right-wing talk radio hosts using racial provocation to maintain the status quo. Because we know white America is steeped in racial resentment. There's no question about that. And so you had someone like Norman Thomas, the socialist presidential candidate in the 1930s, who actually made FDR really embrace the government and use the government to provide solutions for the economic conditions. There is a train of thought out there that says that FDR saved capitalism, because even during the 1930s, if FDR wanted to, he probably could have gotten rid of capitalism, because certainly the American people would have accepted it. Because on the brink of disaster, when we do hit disaster, Americans will accept anything to get us out of the pain, anything to stop the pain. Okay, and then of course in the 1930s you also had the fascist crowd, you had the spread the wealth crowd, the crowd that was trying to make the American people fearful of the isms, the communism, socialism, this ism, and that ism. And now it's you know, the complete opposite. So it's like almost the citizens of the 1930s almost had it better than we do now, because there's no divergence whatsoever. Now it's pretty much, you know, like I said, two political parties, a highly consolidated media which filters out opinions, and you and I who are left holding the bag, you and I who are left having to pay for the debt that they ran up, and yet we're told it's entitlements. No, it's entitlements. It's we're becoming a welfare nation. Chris Christie, you know, we become a welfare nation sitting on the couch waiting for our welfare check. That's what ails us in the minds of the business community, in the minds of the elites. That's what ails us. It's not the debt that they ran up. It's not the, you know, new normals of capitalism. It's laziness, because remember, in capitalist society, it always has to come down to the individual. The capitalists out there, the very elite, the bourgeoisie, whatever you want to call them, they have to make Americans believe that, you know, these are all personal problems. These are all individual problems. Because when you blame the individual, there's no end to how far you can blame the individual. I mean, you know, individuals are politicized in our society. It's easier to, you know, use an individual as, you know, a political football than it is a corporation. You know, it's one of the reasons why we hear so much about the black welfare queen, the stereotypical welfare queen, the young buck in the supermarket buying a steak. It's one of the reasons why, you know, because it's easy to politicize, and that message resonates with white America. And, you know, so look over here, don't look over there. You know what I'm saying? And so now we're just trapped. You know, we don't have an alternative. We the progressives have disappeared from the discourse, and, you know, we're served up, oh, Bernie Sanders and, oh, Elizabeth Warren. Now, these people, they're not there to change anything. They're not going to change anything, because the system is designed to preserve the status quo. They're there to create the appearance of diversity. They're there to, you know, create the appearance that there's somehow, you know, a alternative view other than, you know, corporate statism. And it's really, really, really disappointing. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, during the 1930s, the lords and masters...
I got no soul. Life in prison, no parole, no control. Food, I got my number on a wiretap. Cause I jacked for Similac. Fuck a Cadillac, so fine. One motive, no focus. Every sidewalk, the focus like a tightrope. Yes, I know my deadline, sire. With my life in fire, the sentence ring resembling of the barbed wire. The mother of my genre, who's a mind at my grave. It's my life for that life, so call it a free trade. Well, neither am I even born a star. I took a death trip when I tried to cross. White wall.
white wall.
Live. I'm sorry about that. I hope you can hear me. For some reason, I was disconnected from the internet. And I really believe that somewhere in the business community, some evil businessman probably just got back from a ball or something, right? He's listening, and he somehow disrupted my internet connection. I know it. I'm telling you. I'm just kidding. But it's just weird. I don't know. I hope that everything turned out okay. I hope that you guys have been able to hear me. We're talking about the corporate state, capitalism, the conditions of capitalism, the new normal of capitalism, Ralph Nader's book, Unstoppable, the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, and just how both parties are out to screw you. Corporate welfare is a bipartisan thing. It's more varied now than it has been in a while. And before we had the blackout, we were talking about the 1930s and everything. Well, there was a real consensus that we have to. I mean, even though after the Great Depression, and really with the FDR and his New Deal program. So it was centralized planning. It was, the government turning to the defense industry and the government working together with the establishment of various government programs that put millions and millions of people to work. Now we don't have a government anymore. We have a corporate government, okay? Corporations control our government. They control the laws that are being written. They control the implementation of the laws. Corporations and the corporate state have the ability to co-opt any effort within the system, which is why I said earlier in the program that the minimum wage efforts in America, it's great that Socialist Council member of Seattle, Swami, I can't pronounce her name, I'm sorry. I don't even remember her name. Yeah, Swami Savant, just butchering it, but there's a reason why it's almost futile, because that movement and that effort will be co-opted by the business community no matter, which way you slice it. There's no question about that. In Boston, Danny Heifung of the Black Agenda Report, told us about this last week on this program, how in Boston you had a raise in the minimum wage to something like $11 an hour. But that effort is being co-opted by the business community, who has all the power, and it'll be nullified. By the time it goes into effect, it'll be nullified. It's not going to exist anymore, which is why you can't – voting is useless. Our government they're invalid. Yet that's how you – the media, it's invalid. The government in its current state is invalid, okay? So therefore, if you believe that, if you, you know, understand it, if you pay attention and you see all efforts to try to reform the system as being, you know, useless, then you can't, you have to withdraw from the current system. You have to create new consciousness out there that, and you know, contribute to, you know, change the course of discussion. Don't assimilate. And you know, this is why I tell you to support efforts like the Zeitgeist Movement, okay? I've had members from the Zeitgeist Movement on, and I'll continue to have them. Very, very important stuff. It really speaks to the market system and just how inherently flawed we are. And I'll give you an example. This is from the work of Peter Joseph, who I consider to be an intellectual authority in our community. You know, Peter Joseph talks about how the incentive for market-based competition is the idea that we receive the lowest, the best possible goods for the lowest possible prices, okay? And that's really what we're taught about capitalism, is that, you know, capitalism produces the best possible prices or the best possible products for the lowest possible prices. Now, the problem with that, and that's, I mean, that's like really, you know, sacred. You can't, you know, get around that. That's just, you know, woven into the fabric of our discussion, just everything. Well, what Peter Joseph points out, and the members of the Zeitgeist Movement point out, is that in order for something to, in order for a company to be competitive, because we have an economy that's built on competition, and competition inevitably breeds scarcity, right, where things have to be valuable. In order to have that, it is critical for things to break down, for things to become inferior the moment they're released. Companies put cost-saving measures at every stage of production, because at the end of the day, the last thing, if a businessman is selling you his product, he wants to sell you many products. You know, solving problems and having people, you know, basically efficiency is the enemy of the marketplace. In order for our market to continue, in order for consumption to continue, in order for us to consume, it's critical that things break down. It's critical that we do not have efficiency. You know, products that are being made now are being designed to maintain the lifespan of cyclical consumption. And this is really an economic rule, you know, in our country. It's a given, right? And so we put that above all else, and so what emerges from that is sustainability and efficiency are enemies of the marketplace, okay? And, you know, another concept introduced within the Zeitgeist movie is the anti-economy. We don't have an economy, we have an anti-economy, because, you know, one of the definitions given of our economy is the conservatively orienting the material goods and production for life-supporting products. Okay, now our system, as we point out, is very wasteful. It's very, very inefficient. One look at the defense industry lets you understand that. We have a corrupt process. We have a corrupt procurement process. We have, you know, the corporations that are the seekers that are siphoning our tax dollars and going up and blowing things up overseas and sending our military to 140 countries and whatever it is, and there are 140 military bases, and you know, losing billions and billions and trillions of dollars. In fact, there was one report that came out, and this is such an indictment on capitalism. It is such an indictment on a disgusting country that there was one fighter program, one Pentagon program, worth 396. I'm going off memory here. If the numbers are subject to, but I remember it was $396 billion for this fighter jet program. Okay, useless fighter jet program that doesn't work. You hear so many times about these Pentagon fighter jets that don't work, they don't fly in the rain, whatever the hell. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars. 50 cents of every federal tax dollar that goes to the government is siphoned by this goddamn defense industry, this military industrial complex. And you know, you get these yahoos, these Fox News yahoos, and these Tea Party people, you know, thinking that this is the salvation. If we spend, you know, $1 trillion, it's not government spending unless it goes to a minority. It's not government spending, you know, unless it goes to help a poor person, right? And so every person, every homeless person in America could receive a house for $600,000, okay, if we didn't waste $400 billion on this stupid defense program, this stupid fighter pilot, whatever the hell it is. Doesn't that make you sick to be an American? Doesn't that make you ashamed to be an American? We could solve homelessness. With you know, less than half of the Pentagon budget, you can give someone a house that is a mansion. You could buy every homeless person a mansion. But this is the contradiction of capitalism, is that we have all of this wealth. We have people in this country. We've got the Walton family that have more wealth than, you know, 30% of Americans. You've got any of these scumbags on the Fortune 400 list that have probably more wealth than half the damn country. Get all of the income growth. Their children grow up in a sheltered environment, have access to elite institutions, okay, have needs addressed, have just all the advantages in life. These people have everything, and we all have nothing, right? And you know, this continues. This is the status quo. With the Wall Street bailout that we had, we could solve poverty, you know, for generations. But the problem is that there's no profit in that. In doing the right thing in America, doing the saving lives, creating a sustainable environment, right? Expanding the life sequence. There's no profit in that. There's only profit in making problems. And Michael Rupert talks about how, you know, problems create profits, which is why we're all about profits in America, and we're experiencing more problems than virtually any industrialized country. It makes me sick to be an American. It's a value system disorder. And we need to fight back. We really do. I'm Bob Carson. This has been Carson's Corner. I want to tell you could friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Make sure to support the election boycott advocates. Support, I forget the website. I think it's, you could just find it on Facebook. All right. And make sure to follow me on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/BobCarsonMMA. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.